So how can we make this case? Well, one way we can do it is to point out to people that there's no essential difference between the embryos you once were and the adults you are today that would justify killing you at that earlier stage.
Arguments cannot be religious or non-religious. Arguments can either be valid or invalid, or sound or unsound.
The substance view is the idea that from when you come into existence at fertilization until you die naturally, you are the same individual at every point in your life. So if it is wrong to kill you now, it was wrong to kill you then. Hello and welcome to Pro-Life Thinking, a Life Training Institute podcast in which we discuss the abortion issue and larger issues related to bioethics in a way that's winsome, reasonable, and persuasive. I'm your host, Clinton Wilcox, and today I have a very special guest joining me, a man who probably needs no introduction to a good number of my listeners. My guest for today is John Elefante. John is the former lead singer of Kansas and has also enjoyed a distinguished music career with his band Mastodon and as a solo artist. John now sings for the J Seculo Band, which is another name probably familiar to a good number of my listeners, as J Seculo is a pro-life attorney who also does work in the movement. John, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's actually a big honor for me to have you. I've been a fan of Kansas for a long time, and a fan of yours since I had just gotten out of high school, so it's a really big honor to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
The first question that I have for you is a question from a listener on Facebook, Brent Taylor. He wants to know if you'd share your testimony with us. Were you raised a Christian, or did you have a conversion experience?
I had a conversion experience. I was not raised a Christian, although my mom always suggested that we got involved in some capacity with a church. But I got saved when I was about 20 years old. A friend came back into my life that I'd known most of my life, and he was a buddy that we used to just kids do and have fun and anyway, make a long story short, he came back into my life and he was noticeably different. He's now a pastor of a church in Southern California, about 3,000. So he's come a long way. He was noticeably different, and he introduced me to I always knew about God and the existence of God, and God really had no role in my life at that time. He really set a challenge for me, and I didn't get saved at first. It took me a while. He took me to some Bible studies at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa. Some of you listeners probably know about that. And it really started to seep in. And I think what scared me the most was how I'd have to change my life, my music, my friends, my clothes, for that matter. the enemy doesn't want to see that conversion, so he's going to throw up as many roadblocks as he can, and he did. And that was the scariest part, I think. And it wasn't until my friend Mark, that turned me out of it, that brought me to the Lord, gave me a book called Evidence Demands a Verdict by Josh McDowell. And I read that book a few times, and I think there's a line in the book that, or something to the effect of, that it takes more faith to not believe than to believe. And I bought into that hook, line, and sinker, because I truly believe that was true. Mm-hmm. And I called Mark and I said, I'm ready, man. I want to get saved. And he came over to my house, and we had converted my parents' garage into an 8-track studio. Yeah. And it was really soundproof, and we went in the control room, and I accepted the Lord right there.
That's cool.
And everything that I feared about what I'd have to change, God took control of that, and it just worked itself out in a very profound way.
And now, one of the first questions that I like to ask my guests is, why are you pro-life? Was it something that was kind of an outcropping of your Christian beliefs, or did you come to them basically independent of that?
You know, I didn't used to be pro-life, and I didn't used to be pro-choice. I'm talking about many years ago, because I never really thought about it. You know, it wasn't that important to me, because I wasn't as spiritually aware as I have been in the last 30-something years. But then, you know, when it started to become an issue, and I was challenged on what do you believe about abortion, it wasn't a very hard choice for me to make. That why should anybody have the right to end a life that God has created? And I think it was especially when my daughter, who the video, I don't know if you've seen the video this time. Well, she was literally minutes from being aborted, maybe seconds. I think that's when it hit me really hard. I don't know if I'm answering your question correctly, Clinton, but, you know, I just decided that I should back up and tell you that when I wrote that song and we did the video, it wasn't made per se to be a big pro-life statement. And I don't want your listeners to take that wrong, because I'm extremely pro-life, and I've done many speaking engagements, some with Alveda King. But the song was written from just what it is. I mean, my daughter was almost aborted. I heard the story from her birth mother and always wanted to write about it. And I written this piece of music, and I said, this is the song where I need to tell her story. And, you know, so I told the story in the song, we did the video, and, you know, it's an honest song about how she came into the world and how she almost didn't. And I soon realized, you know, when I started doing a lot of interviews after the song, that it had become somewhat of a pro-life anthem. And I was pleased about that. It's like, you know, I didn't really intend to do that, but that's what happened. And I was very pleased about that, actually.
So would you say then that it's sort of God using the song in a way that you didn't necessarily intend, but in a way that was more toward his purpose?
Well, as I was writing it, I mean, I knew that it would be controversial. But that didn't bother me. I mean, you know, Christ is controversial for that matter.
Right.
I didn't care about that. I was willing to face the reality on that. And there was a lot of vitriol when the video came out. But no, it was, I simply just wanted to tell the story. And if people are going to be offended, I mean, too bad. That's the way it happened. And, you know, it's really interesting to read the comments on YouTube underneath the video. Most people really, really like it and are really, really affected by it. But some people absolutely hate it, want to kill me, and wish, wish cancer on me. You know,
right?
That's how strong of a subject matter abortion is. I mean, there are people that are so outrageously pro-choice. You know, how dare you tell a woman to do, you know, what to do with her body? And, you know, we've heard all the cliche lines.
Right.
But some of them were just downright almost threatening and just total hatred at me and the song and the subject. And by the way, I want to add that when I first did the song, we tried to get it on radio because I wanted to get it out there. And we couldn't get any Christian radio stations to play it. Zero.
No.
Nobody would play it. Too controversial. Too much for our listeners. And I was blown away. And just how miraculous God works is I got a call out of the blue one day from a guy that said, hey, why don't you, you know, I heard you talking about the fact that you tried to get the song on radio and nobody would play it. why don't you do a video? A video doesn't have the same shelf life that a radio single has. And I said, well, I don't really have the funds to make a video right now. What this song is about sounds like an expensive video. And he said, how about if I turn you on to a company? At the time, it was called Online for Life. Now they're called Human Coalition. Great organization. Fabulous. How about if I can get them to pay for the video? Sounds interesting. Let me know what happens. A few days later, he goes, okay, how much you need? And I think I had a check in my account within 2 days.
Wow.
So they really stepped up, and if it wasn't for them, this video probably wouldn't have been made. And we know for a fact that it's probably a whole lot more, but we know of at least 5 or 6 babies that have been saved as a result of the video, but there's probably many more.
Yeah, it definitely has the potential to save a lot of lives, considering the story behind it. Let's come back to this time in just a moment. For those who may be unfamiliar with you, I'd like to talk about your music career just a little bit, and then we can come back to talk about the song. You were the lead singer for Kansas in the early 80s. What led to your getting hired to be the frontman for Kansas?
Gosh, that's a...
that's kind of reaching back a little bit.
Yeah, I'll try and truncate it a little bit.
All right.
We were shopping for a record deal. My brother and I, we had about 4 or 5 originals that we'd recorded in that little studio I told you we converted my parents' garage into. And a friend of mine, incidentally, that was in the same band that the guy that brought me to the Lord, a guy named Mark Ambrose. Do you remember a band called Idle Cure?
I've heard the name. I don't know if I've heard any songs by them.
They were a popular Christian rock band in the mid to late 80s and before. But the guitar player in that band, he pulls in my driveway, and he's like almost speeding. He couldn't wait to get out of his car. And he said, John, the original singer from Kansas left the band, Steve Walsh. He goes, you need to go for it, man. You got the perfect voice for this. I said, whoa, slow down. He said, yeah, man, you got to try and do an audition. I mean, auditioning people. And it's like, wow. And, I didn't think in a million years I would ever be able to land that gig because, I mean, I idolized Steve Walsh as a singer. He was one of my favorites, growing up. But to cut to the chase, we were using an attorney to shop our demo. And I called the attorney and I said, hey, do you have any way of getting a tape to the band Kansas? He says, it's funny you ask. The attorney that sits next to me in my office represents Kansas.
Oh.
So I said, he had a handful of our demo. I said, can you give him one? I'm just thinking hit or miss. Probably 1 in a million chance.
Yeah.
So I guess he went ahead and gave him the tape, and the attorney passed it on to the manager. And about a week later, I got a call from the manager. And he wanted to meet me in person, and I went up to Hollywood and met with him, and he said, I'd like to have a couple of guys in the band have some, phone conversations with you. And one thing led to another. They flew me to Atlanta. I mean, there were a lot of people auditioning, from what I hear, with Sammy Hagar. And
oh, wow.
A lot of people auditioned for the gig. And I flew to Atlanta, and we rehearsed mostly my songs. They wanted to hear my songs because they needed more songs for the album. They were getting ready to start. And I was there about a week, and one day I came in, they said, you got the gig, welcome to the band. I was like, what? And it was really a huge part of my life. I mean, it really set me up for a lot of things that I've done since.
Yeah.
Which is, there's a lot in between then and now. So that's how that happened. I mean, we had I had two top 10 singles with those guys, and quite remarkable.
Yeah, I actually just recently heard your two Kansas albums for the first time, because I've been looking for those two CDs, Vinyl Confessions and Desperate Measures, for a long time, but it was out of print for quite some time, and so very expensive to get the CDs, but they were recently, from what I found on Amazon, reprinted on CD, so I was able to pick up a couple copies and listen to them. So,
well, they've been reissued on Epic Classics, and there's a company out of Europe that has packaged those two CDs together and is also selling.
And so then how did you end up getting the gig singing for the Jay Sekulow Band?
Oh, there's a lot of time went by in between the Kansas years and the Jay Sekulow Band. I mean, a lot of years. But I'd be glad to answer your question. You know what? That happened by John Schlitt, the singer in Tetra, called me, and he said, Jay Sekulow's a friend of mine, and I was telling him about you, and Jay asked if I would bring you by. He'd like to meet you. And I said, yeah. You know, we set up a date, like, for a week later, and John and I met for lunch, and then he took me over to Jay's office, where Jay does his radio program from. He's since moved. And I met Jay and just really, really took a liking to him, and I think he took a liking to me. And when he was done with his radio show, he called on a couple of guys in his office that played instruments, and, you know, we just started singing a couple of tunes, and you know, it started out just as a fun thing that Jay would do after his radio show.
Mm.
You know, just as kind of a stress relief, you know?
Yeah.
So he said, hey, man, you want to come out again Friday? Well, you know, I want to put you on the show. Let's talk about it, because my new album really had just come out, On My Way to the Sun, which is the song This Time appears on. And so he goes, you know, I'd be glad to plug the record and the song and tell people about the video and this and that. And so we got to the point where, you know, we were kind of getting together and just jamming every couple of weeks. It wasn't that serious. He would tape some of the little jams we did and play them in the bumpers of him, his radio show. And, you know, one thing led to another, and then we started making a couple of serious videos. He had another place in his office where he had multi-camera shoots. And so, you know, we started, you know, this became like almost, you know, we'd get together almost every Monday night or Tuesday night or whatever. And rehearse a little bit, and whatever song kind of surfaces the best, we would do a video to. And it just started getting more serious and more serious and more serious. And we started doing a couple live shows, and we added Mark Townsend to the band, who was with DC Talk. And Mark became the music director of the band. It's certainly something I didn't want to do. I mean, it was just, I like showing up and singing. I mean, when you meet the music director, it's just so much work, you know, and Mark's really, really highly technical as well. And I'm not really that technical of a guy. Still, so we formed a band and found the right keyboard player, and John Lowry, that was with Fetcher as well. And, it started getting a lot more serious, and probably a lot of people hate me for doing that too, but I don't really care.
Right. Yeah.
And
I mean,
Jay's doing some remarkable things in the pro life, in the pro life realm. I mean, just, I get his newsletter every day, and he's on it every day, man. That guy is really, really dedicated to this mission.
Yeah. I just recently discovered Jay Sekulow Band. I was really surprised to see that he had gotten so many well-known and great musicians for his band, you know, with you and the two guys from Petra and Mark Townsend from DC Talk. And DC Talk was actually the first band I'd ever discovered in the Christian realm. I didn't even know there was such a thing as Christian rock until a friend showed me the Jesus Freak song in 1999. And at that point, I remember hearing a lot of your solo material on the radio, which is why it kind of surprises me to hear that you can't find a Christian radio station to play this time because it's too controversial. But I remember hearing your songs pretty frequently back when I discovered Christian rock music in 99.
Wow, that's great. Yeah.
Yes, like you mentioned, there are a lot of years between Kansas and Jay Sekulow Band. Because you'd mentioned that you were shopping around for a label, and then you got into Kansas at that point. Was Kansas kind of the first band that you had been with, or did you have anything prior to that?
No, that's a whole other story. But I'll keep it short. I've been doing this since I was about 12 or 13 years old.
Okay.
And I did an interview the other day, and I was telling this gentleman that when I was 14 years old, we got a gig at Disneyland in California, in the Tomorrowland stage, the one that comes up out of the ground. We would do four sets, four 35-minute sets a night. And I was in a band called the Brotherhood. That was an extremely popular top 40 band in California. It was me and my brother and my two cousins. And, man, we did everything from weddings to, high school proms, I mean, junior high prom. But we were booked solid all the time. And so I got a really early start doing this, and started getting paid as a musician when I was as young as 13 years old.
Mm.
So it didn't just start with Kansas. I mean, we were going at it heavily since I was very young.
You also headed up a band called Mastodon. That was after your stint with Kansas, correct?
Yes. Mastodon, after I left Kansas, I started writing a bunch of songs. And we didn't really know what to do with them at that point. So we started recording them. And we used a lot of different singers. It was kind of like an Alan Parsons project. It was kind of like a studio band with many different players: Dave Amato from Mario Speedwagon, David Pack from Ambrosia, John Petitucci on bass, some musicians on the Who He Is. And it was kind of a studio project that we released, and it did extremely well. In fact, one was called Boscadio. And it was one of the longest running number one albums on CCM charts. I mean, ever, like 100 weeks or something.
Hmm.
It was just crazy.
Yeah.
And it started getting real popular in Europe. And somebody told me several months ago that some of those records and CDs on eBay are like as much as $300.
Oh.
But they're just now being reissued by somebody out there, so, and they're coming out on vinyl as well. But that was interesting because we got to use a lot of we got just to hand pick our musicians,
It was
a lot of fun.
Yeah, and so you eventually formed a record label of your own, didn't you? Pachyderm Records, I think, is what you called it.
Yes, it was my brother and I. We signed different artists through the years, and it did pretty well. I mean, a lot of we really had a big emphasis on what bands were saying lyrically. Mm. That's really what separates a secular band from a Christian band, in my opinion. It's what you're saying lyrically.
Yeah,
I don't know that there's any delineation between Christian music on its own. It really comes down to what the lyrics are saying.
Yeah, and so your brother, his name is Dino, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've basically been partnering with your brother for a long time, a few decades at least.
Oh, yeah. we've been partners since I can remember.
Hmm.
Way back when we were born in New York, Long Island, New York. And yeah, we always had a hankering to play music since we were both real, real young. And incidentally, my parents weren't musical really at all.
Oh.
But I like to tell the story that my parents would spin records all day long, 24/7.
Mm.
You're probably too young to remember when one record would stop and then the next one would drop down.
Yeah, records were a little before my time. I was back in the days of cassettes.
Records are back now, man. See, vinyl has really, really made a comeback.
That's what I hear. My siblings and I actually recently bought my mom a turntable for her birthday because we heard that vinyl was coming back. So regarding the names of the label and your band, Pachyderm and Mastodon, are these kind of a play on your last name, Elefante? Or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hmm. Kind of corny.
Okay.
It works.
That's kind of what I kind of figured. But no, I'm totally into plays on words and puns, so I appreciate the names of your band and label. After Mastodon, is that when you started doing your solo career, or did you have anything kind of between Mastodon and your solo?
We had as we were doing Mastodon, maybe even a little before, is when we met up with the group Petra.
Okay.
And I think we produced 7 or 8 Petra records and had a tremendous amount of success with those guys. Petra was, I was really impressed with their ministry as a whole. And I had never seen the effect on Christian music until I met those guys. Went to their shows and saw people come to the Lord. And, I really got behind what they were doing, so... Dino and I kind of joined the band, if you will, not literally, but we would produce their records, and they wanted our sound, whatever that was.
And you wrote some songs for Petra too, right?
Yeah, we co-wrote a lot of songs. Yeah.
Yeah, Petra is definitely a band that I've come to know, and Bob Herdman is a phenomenal guitar player. Some of his solos are some of my favorite solos of any rock song that I've heard.
Oh, he's great. Yeah. And that's when I met up with John Schlipp. It was, I'll never forget, I think it was way back in 1986 when their singer Greg Valls had left the band. And they were looking for a singer, kind of like Kansas was. And Bob said, "Hey, what about this guy that used to sing with Head East? He's interested in the gig." And we were down in Long Beach at the studio that we built. And we flew John in. And he was a little rusty. He'd be the first one to tell you that. But he got behind the mic, and he had learned a few of the songs that were going to be on the record. And me and Dino and Bob went out to dinner that night and said, "Well, I think he's the guy, man. He's got the right personality. He's in the right place. He's got a great voice. And he really wants to serve the Lord. I think he's the right guy." So...
Mm.
30 years later or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how active Petra is, but I think he still does a couple of gigs with him here and there.
Yeah, I'd heard after they split up, after the Jekyll and Hyde record, that they got back together to do some touring with Greg Volz back as the front man.
Right.
I haven't heard anything from them recently, though.
No, John Schlitz making a good amount of solo records, which are really good. But I think Petra just kind of ran its course. As you know, in the last 10, 15 years, the record business has changed a lot.
Yeah, digital downloads now are the way that music has gone.
Yeah. I have an 18-year-old son. They're all into, they all have Spotify, and that's mainly what they use.
Yeah, and I'm definitely one of the music purists. I prefer to have the original CD with the insert and everything. I'll do digital if there's no other alternatives, but I definitely prefer to have the physical copy.
It's funny, when I put out my last record, I offered digital downloads on my website, and most of the people would write to me because my email address is on my website. And they'd say, "No, we want the CD. We want to read the credits and old school stuff," and I quickly realized that my fan base were the same as what you're describing. They want to feel it and touch it and read it and get into it, A digital download doesn't allow you to do that. That's why I'm excited for this record to be coming out on vinyl, because it's going to be big and the artwork's going to be, the size of a full LP.
So you're releasing On My Way to the Sun on vinyl?
Yeah. And it should be out in a few months. Some of the pressing plants around the world are there's a 2-month wait to even get started on your project. That's how popular they've become.
Oh, wow. Who were some of your inspirations as a musician and a songwriter?
Golly, I go so far. I mean, I go so far this way and that way. I mean, I go all the way from classical music, pop music. Growing up, I used to love the Jackson 5. Chicago, you know, we would listen to Chicago and the Eagles, Elton John, Genesis, Led Zeppelin. I mean, I would just go all the way across the spectrum. I mean, anything good, I hooked on to.
Yeah,
I'll never forget when I heard the first Boston record. I was just It absolutely blew my mind. I'd never heard anything like that.
I can definitely relate to Boston. Fabulous, fabulous band. Do you have any favorite classical composers?
I like Rachmaninoff a lot. You know, a lot of times I'll listen to classical and I won't even check to see who it is, but because I have a playlist on my phone, it's all classical.
Yeah.
And love to listen to it when I just really want to wind down. And you know, I probably should have a better answer for you on who's doing what, but I usually don't even look to see who it is. I just love it.
Do you play any classical, or is it mainly contemporary styles that you play?
No, I don't really play much classical, but there's a lot of classical influence, I think, in songs that I write. Because, you know, especially there's a lot of classical influence in the Kansas stuff. Different time changes, and, you know, and I kind of cut my teeth on that, and I think you can definitely hear that influence in songs that I write.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird story how I first got introduced to Kansas. My dad and my mom were always into classic rock, but not into prog rock. And so I got into high school, and I was in the marching band, and one of our pep tunes was Carry On Wayward Son. I had no idea it was a classic rock song until I heard it on the radio. And then I really enjoyed it, went out and checked out a lot more of Kansas's music, and was just kind of hooked once I started listening. So I was first introduced to it as a pep band tune.
Great band. I mean, it was such an honor to be a part of them. When I was with them, it was all the original guys. I was Dry left and Kerry Livgren left. The band had, you know, that was it for the original Kansas. I mean, obviously, I wasn't an original, but I was with all the original guys other than me.
Right.
So that was. I'll never forget doing shows. I mean, you know, hundreds of shows with him. It was every night was a rush. So much music coming off the stage, and so some of the songs are just so incredibly interesting to listen to, and just to hear the band be able to pull it off live, just like the record, just blew my mind.
Yeah, and so I think I read that you actually had some of the Kansas musicians play on your record, On My Way to the Sun.
Yeah. On My Way to the Sun, I had Rich Williams, the guitar player, and David Ragsdale, the violin player. And the record before that, a record called Revolution of Mind, and Kerry's all over that one.
Oh, cool.
His business is all over that one.
Yeah, so you still keep in touch with the guys that you played with in Kansas then?
Yeah, I do. But mostly Kerry. Kerry's doing a cantata, and I'll probably after this phone call, I'll get back down there and sing some of the. He wants me to sing a couple of songs on the cantata.
Oh,
which he's been working for. Get this, 40+ years. So, Lord willing, one of these days it'll come out.
Yeah, I'd definitely be interested in hearing that. I'm definitely very much a fan of Kerry's songwriting too. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about This Time. You mentioned that This Time, you didn't really write it as a pro-life song or to make a pro-life statement, but more just to kind of tell the story of how she came about. And
I thought that was the most honest way to do it. Because if you set out to write specifically a pro-life song, there's a chance it could come out somewhat contrived. But I had a story that was real.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what a better way to do it than tell a story that's real, that has a heavily pro-life influence to a real story. I mean, it was the perfect marriage.
So that way people won't feel so much that you're preaching to them, but will kind of relate to the events that happened and what this woman went through and things like that.
Exactly. I'll never forget the birth mother telling me the story. And, you know, it stuck in my mind. It was like, when I wrote the song, I could hear her words. And she, you know, she was only a young girl. She was 13 years old, like the song said. You know, and she would stumble over her words a little bit when she would tell me, but as she was telling me the story, it was just so impactful that, you know, she wanted to abort my daughter, Sammy. And she tried, and she went into an abortion clinic somewhere, and you know, she got scared. Not so much at the time about having an abortion, but she got scared, you know, when they laid her on the table and she's looking around at all these instruments, and I guess she started to really get frightened, and she wanted out of there. So as you see in the video, she made her way to a phone and called her mom, and her mom didn't know she was pregnant. And her mom said, "Where are you at?" And she told her, and she said, "Get out of there right now. Just get out of there and wait for me in the street, and I'll come pick you up." And, you know, as the video shows, I mean, it's just the way it happened.
The events that occurred in the video then are the events that really happened. It hasn't really been embellished for storytelling purposes?
No. You know, that there always has to be a little creative license in parts of the video that you don't know, you know, for instance, you know, where it took place. And I mean, I'm sure all that is different, but that's exactly how I remember being told. And it was definitely God's will for, you know, it to happen that way. No doubt in my mind. And by the way, I'm proud to tell you that I've got a granddaughter now. My daughter Sammy now has a 2-year-old who's my granddaughter.
Oh, cool.
So there you go, man. It's like, well, at least if her birth mother would have taken a wrong turn in that clinic, neither one of them would be here.
Yeah, and so I'm assuming Sammy has heard the song.
Oh, yeah, gosh, yeah. She loves sharing it with people. She doesn't care who she shares it with. I mean, she's a hairdresser. Mm. And
okay.
When she was in cosmetology school, she would show it to all her friends. They didn't care what they thought about pro-choice, pro-life. Mm.
Yeah.
"Hey, this is my story. Check it out. You know, I don't care whether you like it or not. Here it is."
So she knows then that her mom had considered abortion?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. I mean, you know, if this is too personal, you know, you can feel free not to answer. I'm just kind of curious. A woman who almost aborts her child kind of seems like that'd be something difficult to talk to the child about. And when Sammy found out, did she take the news pretty well? Or I guess I'm kind of asking that if there are people who are listening who might be in a similar situation, is there something do you have like any advice as far as how to kind of relate this information to the child if you don't want to keep it from her, or...
Let me think how I can answer that question. You have to kind of look at the whole picture. You know, my daughter first found out when she was fairly young that she was adopted. You know, you can't lay that on somebody until they're ready to accept that, you know.
Right.
And the fact that she was almost aborted but wasn't doesn't bother her. Because she feels special. I mean, she really does feel special that, you know, her mother chose life and that her mother chose adoption and that she's, you know, a very well-adjusted, you know, I think she's 25 or 26 now. Gosh. 26. she really feels special. She feels special that, like I said, that her mother chose life and that her mother chose abortion. I mean, her mother chose not to abort, and then her mother chose adoption. I mean, she's taken it very well. She tells the story all the time, the whole story.
Yeah.
And that was her talking at the end of the video, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
She really has a heart for this, and I tell her once in a while, I said, God's going to call you one of these days, you know, to really dive into the pool, so to speak.
Yeah.
And she says, I know, and I'm going to be ready when that happens.
Mm.
But now that she's a mother of a two-year-old, it's a little more difficult, but she's got Dad over here telling the story, so I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
You know, I also like to say that I've heard from a lot of females that have had abortions, and it affects them throughout their entire life. I mean, there isn't. I've heard from women that there isn't a minute that goes by that they don't regret having that abortion, and that's extremely painful and hurtful to a woman that's had an abortion or two or three, sometimes, you know, as many as who knows how many. But I figured out very early in this quest that it's much easier to carry a child for 8 or 9 months, give it up for adoption, than it is to have the guilt of having an abortion in your life and having to live with that the rest of your life.
Mm.
You know, it's very hard for a lot of women keep it inside because they don't want to go spread it around. Oh, I've had two abortions. They don't necessarily want to say it, but they hold it inside, and it's very, very painful. I mean, I've had people come up to me at some of these speaking engagements I've done. I'm pro-life, and they're crying. I mean, they are crying when they're telling me this. You know, if I can only do it over, if I can only do it over, you know. And then I talked to birth mothers that have given their child up for adoption, and those are the success stories that I'd love to hear. Those are the ones I think that relate to the video the most. That did choose life and were too young to parent the child and gave the child up for adoption, and find out years later that their, you know, the child that they gave up for adoption is very well adjusted and, you know, went to a great home. I mean, adoption is such a great alternative, man. There are so many people out there, so many married couples that would love to adopt.
Yeah, I'm, you know, really glad that you're willing to speak up about this issue. I know a lot of musicians don't like to really get political with their career, but you know, I'm really glad that you're out there being able to help these women who've been through this situation.
It's I'm privileged that God has used this situation in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's I've written a lot of music, and I've won Grammy Awards and have plenty of gold and platinum records, but I think this is one of my crowning achievements, was to, you know, have the ability to have adopted and, you know, and given a child. Well, I have two adopted kids. I don't think I told you that. 3 years after we adopted Sammy, the same organization where we got Sammy called and said, how would you like to have a little boy? He said, sounds good. And we were right in the middle of a Petra record, and my wife flew out to California, and she had to stay there and go through some legal stuff. And we adopted my son, Daniel. So, you know, I almost feel like, you know, God chose us to do this. And it's like, it's really a cool feeling, you know, that God would consider me you know, able to parent these two children that, you know, I mean, ultimately, and this was told to me by, we by the way, we adopted Sammy and Daniel from a place called House of Roots, which is run by a pastor's wife in Southern California, Calvary Chapel Downey. House of Ruth is I can't tell you what an amazing organization it is. They only take the small donation. They're not baby brokers. She told me once something that was very profound. And at first it hit me like, what? But then when you start thinking about it, it's very true. She said, adoption is not God's perfect will. God, you know, God loves adoption and is very, very much for it. But God's perfect will is for a child to be born to a mother and a father. And at first that struck me a little strange that she would say that. But after I thought about it, I thought, well, no, she's right. It's not God's perfect will. I don't want to confuse you by saying that, but I don't quite know how to get the words out that I'm trying to say, but it's a very good option. Extremely good option that you know that I advocate.
Yeah, I definitely am fully in favor of adoption. And, you know, I agree with the pastors who said that, too, that it's not the perfect situation, but in a bad situation where the parents are unable to raise a kid, I think it's a good alternative for that situation.
Oh, yeah, it's a fabulous alternative.
What has been the general reaction from fans and the public then about the song and the video? You mentioned some of the negative backlash you've got, but what's kind of been the overall general reaction from people about the song and video?
Extremely positive. Extremely. There's no in between. There's no like, yeah, it's okay. They either absolutely love it and share it with everybody they know, or they absolutely hate it. There's a guy that hated it so much when I put out the video that he made his own video.
Oh.
And it was directly pointed at me. And this, you know, the guy's using the most foul language you've ever heard.
Mm.
And he's just, I mean, the hate and the vitriol coming from this person.
Yeah.
I don't even know if it still has it up. It might be. But it's absolutely disgusting. When I saw it, it just turned my stomach. Mm. And this guy took the time to make this video. That's how much he hated out.
Yeah, and you know, the reason I was asking about the story as depicted in the video is true, not that I was doubting that it was true, but I know a lot of times pro-choice people will often think that pro-life people are kind of lying about how we talk about abortion. And so I just kind of wanted to kind of lay that out there, and that, you know, the story as depicted, you know, there's probably a little bit of poetic license taken, but in general, that was how it happened. And so it was just my main motivation for that, because I have a lot of conversations with pro-choice people. And when you see a movie like Unplanned or Gosnell that kind of talk about what goes on, often they'll have these accusations.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, well, we're actually coming up to the end of our time together here. Do you have any projects going on now that you'd like to promote?
I'm doing some work with Kerry Livgren, not only the cantata, but I'm also doing some stuff for one of his solo records that hopefully will soon be released. I'm going to start another solo record myself.
Hmm.
Because of the song this time, On My Way to the Sun was very successful.
Hmm.
I mean, to today's standards of record sales, if you want to use that as a barometer, it did very well. And I think a lot of it, And who knew when I wrote that song that it would be, you know, who knew that it would be the most important song on that record, but it really catapulted that record, you know, and praise God that it did, because then, you know, people got to hear the other 9 songs as well.
Right, right. Yeah, and I'll post a link in the show notes also to the organizations that you mentioned here, the Human Coalition and House of Ruth.
yeah, in case anyone has some, you know, further inquiries about them, especially because House of Ruth is doing really good work in adoption. And I'll also post a link to where they can, to your website, where they can find your albums.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, I really appreciate you giving your time. And like I said, I've been a fan of Kansas and of you for a while. And so I'm, you know, I just really, really an honor for me to be able to interview you on my show.
I appreciate it. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
If you enjoyed my interview with John Elefante today, I would just ask that you share this around social media. You can rate us on iTunes, on our Facebook page, and other places you find us. You can also find us on blogtalkradio.com/prolifethinking. And of course, give us a review if you'd like. We don't always receive notifications when we receive reviews, but I've been checking a lot more recently in case certain people have recommendations for the show. And so we'll be touching on some of those in the future. And now this is a weekly podcast, and it takes a lot of work to put together a podcast each week on top of all the other work that I do in the pro-life movement. As Greg Cunningham of Center for Bioethical Reform says, there are a lot more people working to kill unborn babies full-time than there are people working to save them full-time. I subsist off of donations from financial supporters. People like you keep me being able to do the work that I do. If you like what we're doing with this podcast and would like to support my work as a full-time pro-life advocate, you can go to www.prolifetraining.com and click on Donate in the menu on the top. You can give a one-time gift or you can give a monthly gift. Just be sure to put my name in the notes section so that Life Training Institute knows to put your donation into my account. And donations are also tax-deductible. And if you'd like to donate to this podcast specifically, then also indicate that in the notes as well. Now, John has been gracious enough to allow me to close the show out today by playing his song this time. I think it's a really great song. I would encourage you to go download it if you can, or just buy the whole album, too. Yeah, I'm going to play the song, and I will put in the show notes a location where you can buy the song or where you can buy the album. And I'll post a link to John's website as well as the other websites that I indicated here. So once again, I'd like to thank John for joining me with this interview. And I'd like to thank you, the listener, for listening in. And we'll see you next time.
Sat cold in a waiting room, frightened and all alone. Watched the clock tick down, knowing that her baby would soon be gone. Her head slung low, so embarrassed, she was 13 years old. She felt a kick inside as a reminder of a life she couldn't show. Then she heard a voice inside say, she fell into a light sleep, had a dream about a little girl. There was a birthday cake and three candles, she was living in another world. She saw the little girl become a woman, living in a happy home. Then she was suddenly awakened by a voice that called her name. They said, don't worry, time. No, you're not taking her this time. She laid flat on the table. She asked, please, can I talk to someone? But a headstrong woman with a blank stare said, we've got to get this done. Then she cried out loud, please help me. I've got to get to a phone. I need to call. Don't worry, you'll be fine. You're still young, we see this all the time. taking this time. No, you're not taking this time. This time, no, you're not taking her this time.